My guest today is Dion DiMucci, better known as Dion, is a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer whose career covers six decades, and he's still rocking and a-rolling. Now, before there was the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, Dion was one of the most prominent rock and roll performers of the pre-British Invasion era. Now, initially, the lead singer of the vocal group Dion and the Belmonts, he then embarked on a solo career. He had 39 top 40 hits in the late 1950s and early 1960s as a solo performer or with the Belmonts and the Del Satins. Now, he is best remembered for his signature hit songs, Run Around Sue, The Wanderer, Ruby Baby, and Lovers Who Wander, among others. Now, during the 1980s, Dion produced several Christian albums, winning a GMA Dove Award in 1984 for the album I Put Away My Idols. But the Grammy-nominated artist was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1989, along with the Rolling Stones and Otis Redding. And in 2002, Dion was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame for Run Around Sue. Even a musical based on Dion's life, The Wanderer, debuted in 2021, telling a story of transformation and personal redemption. Now, he has his 42nd album debuting called Dion and Girlfriends, a rockin' album you've got to hear. So ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome the rock and roll legendary icon. Hey, he's rock and roll royalty, the one and the only Dion to the show. Welcome.
What can I say after that? I'll leave right now. Goodbye.
Well, I tell you what, You have been rocking and rolling for over 60 years, and you're not slowing down.
You know, I'm blessed. I'll be honest with you. I just have great energy, and I don't know. I think my parents had something to do with it. My mom died at 104. She was still working and thinking good, and my father was, I don't know, they were like built like tanks, you know. I don't know. So I think I got a couple of good genes in there, and I have a lot of faith, and I have a wonderful wife. We've been married over 60 years. I have three daughters and five grandchildren, and they keep me young. And the music, I tell you, Ward, the music keeps me young. You know, it does. And in fact, be honest with you, I'm glad I lived this long, because the last three albums, I think, have been like the best of my whole career. I've been writing songs, and I've been getting better. You know, I have a gift, and I try to hone it, but I've been getting better. The skills and the words and the music, and I'm just enjoying it more than ever. I feel like I caught a wave, and I'm just riding it, you know?
Well, you know, I've loved your last three albums, but I want to ask you, because you grew up in the Bronx, but you had a love for country music. How did an Italian-American kid fall in love with country music, especially Hank Williams?
Yeah, it is kind of strange. I talked to Springsteen and Paul Simon and Lou Reed about this a lot, because for a guy like Elvis Presley, it came naturally. He was there. He was in Memphis. But I wasn't. I was in the Bronx. But there was a guy named Don Larkin who was a guy who fell in love with country music, and he started a show out of Newark. I forget the name of it, but it was a Don Larkin show. And he would, one day, I remember it, Ward, like when I was like 10 years old, 11 years old, I heard this honky-tonk blues coming out of the radio. And it changed my life. It kind of hurled me into a place of transcendence, or enchantment, like a place of delight, like that you don't experience on this plane, you know? And I fell in love with the music, and I ran up to Fordham Road. I asked my father to take me up there, and I made friends with a guy named Lou Cicchetti, who owned Cousins Record Store. And every time a Hank Williams record came in, he would call my house and we would go up there and pick the record up. I knew by the time I got on tour with Buddy Holly and Waylon Jennings, I knew about 40 Hank Williams songs. I knew the backsides. They were going, "What song is that?" I said, "That's the backside of Jambalaya." "What song is that?" "Oh, that's Luke the Drifter," you know.
Well, you know, your father was a vaudeville entertainer. I mean, what was your home life like before you became an international rock star?
My parents didn't drink. They didn't drug. They didn't carouse. They didn't drink coffee. They didn't smoke. They weren't bigots. They just argued all the time. They just argued 24 hours a day. So when I got a guitar, I'd go in the room. They'd argue. I'd close the door, and I became a, you know, I got better on the guitar, you know.
Well, what was your first guitar?
What? I wish I had it. I think it was an L1 Gibson. My mom and my uncle bought it in a hock shop. It was like the original Robert Johnson guitar, you know. They bought it for $8. If I had that guitar now, I could retire.
An L1, you better believe you could retire.
it was something. Had a big, you know, fat neck, but I love the guitar, you know. And I have pictures of me playing it. I'll send you one when after we
Man, do this. I would love to see that. Sometimes I like to go online, and I'm sure you do too, and look up the vintage guitars and just and you now realize how much these things are worth, and thinking, yeah, like you said, if you had it, you could sell it and literally retire. Well, I noticed that in one of your new videos, I think it was definitely in Soul Force, and I'm just going to go ahead and bring this up because I noticed your guitar. You play a Telecaster, but the name on the headstock is Bluesman. Is that in accordance to you, or is that a company?
No, it's just a sticker. You know, I fancy myself a blues man from another Delta.
Well, you know, I've been to the Delta, especially places like Greenville, Mississippi. It's places like that where they've just got lost in time. Things just haven't changed.
You know, Ward, I heard Hank Williams as a youngster. And it just, like I said, it enthralled me. It got me on this road. And I'm still, till this, I mean, this very moment, I'm still the same. I want to fashion a song so as to I can transmit it to you or someone else to make them feel what I felt when I was 12 or what I still feel when I hear not only a Hank Williams song, but after I heard Hank Williams, I heard Jimmy Reed. And I saw Jimmy Reed at the Apollo Theater, you know, in Harlem, which was a stone's throw from where I was living. But, you know, I could define it now, maybe not back then, but I really wanted to communicate like Hank Williams, and I wanted to roll like Jimmy Reed. He just had that, you know, that way of just, you know, you call it rock and roll. He rolls, man.
Well, how old were you when you started going to the Apollo Theater?
Well, then I was about 16. I'd go down there with my friends, you know, and we'd run down to the first row, you know, and Big Al Sears would come out with his white suit and his white shoes and his that golden horn and the big Apollo Theater band, and he would just get up there and bap, bap, la da 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 da, bap, booty, bap, da 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 da, bit, bit, bap, booty, bap, booty, bap, bap, la da 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 da, bap, dee da da da, bit, bap, la da 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 da. And we would go, we would get up and we'd start dancing, and I go back to the neighborhood, and I got these three guys. I say, do this, did it, did. Did, did it, did it, did it. You know, I try to imitate the band. And that's what some of those early records were, like The Wanderer and Run Around Sue. We were trying to imitate the Apollo band, you know. Especially on I Wonder Why. You know, we started with we had all kinds of intros, but the first doo-wop song that we put together, I kind of recruited these doo-wop singers from my neighborhood, you know, from different neighborhoods, the best of the different neighborhoods. And we put the song together, I Wonder Why. And the first time we did it in my room, in my parents' apartment, Carlo sang bass, Freddie sang, he sang falsetto, but low, a low falsetto, and then we had a tenor. And I sang lead, and we sounded like we were on a carousel, you know? I felt like I was in heaven or something, because we were all doing a different thing, you know? But we started the song, like I said, like a sax. Den 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 I started getting better with the words as I went along. And like I said, I'm getting better. I'm getting better now. I'm right.
Well, how did you get discovered?
Well, there was a guy, a black dude in my neighborhood. His name was Willie Green. And he was the superintendent of one of the tenement buildings. And he played guitar. And I was in junior high school. I must have been 14. I used to run home to hear that Don Larkin show to tape some songs, you know, because my landlady lent us her Pentron tape recorder. And I'd record maybe Lefty Frizzell and a Hank Williams and a Carl Smith song. But Willie Green lived right around the corner from me, and he was a janitor, and he played guitar, and he listened to, you know, I mean, he was into John Lee Hooker, you know. You know, and he played it, and I couldn't wait to get with the guy. It was just, I was taken with this stuff. I was a dreamer. Like, I was in school, my head was out the window, you know what I'm saying? Like, they had to wake me up. I was like, thinking of getting with Willie Green and hearing some of that guitar playing and some of those songs. It was so magical to me, you know, mesmerizing. So, and I tell you, I'm 84 years old. I'm still like that. You know what I'm saying? I haven't let go of it. I still wake up with that love for that, those sounds and that trip.
So did you cut a demo of some sort and get discovered?
Well, Willie Green, like, he knew a guy in the neighborhood, was a songwriter. Sorry for not answering the question.
That's all right.
This guy, Johnny Noto, he said, why don't you take Dion down to that new record? There were these two guys, Gene and Bob Schwartz, who opened up a small record company. They had a little room, and it was nothing back then. It was maybe 1957. And I took the train down to I was 17, brought my guitar down there, and auditioned at Laurie Records. They were called Mohawk at the time, Mohawk Records, but then they turned it into Laurie Records. But I walked in and I played a Fats Domino song, Rosalie, and I played a Carl Perkins tune, you know, All My Friends Are Bopping the Blues. And maybe I played a John Lee Hooker. They went crazy. They went nuts. They were like, where'd you come from? And I had to call my parents, and they came down to witness the signature. They signed me that day. And that was it. You know, I got this record contract when I was about 17. And then they wanted to put my voice on this track with this group called the Timberlanes. And the Timberlanes were like from Oklahoma or something, you know, do-de-o, do-de-o, do-do, you know, like, off to Oklahoma. You know, they were just such bright and cheery and uplifting guy. But I said, nah, that's not, you know, I was listening to the Cleftones and the Moonglows and the Cadillacs, you know, in the candy store. And so I said, let me run back to the neighborhood. I'll recruit some guys from my neighborhood, you know, if you want a group. So I brought down these three guys from my neighborhood, and we called ourselves Dion and the Belmonts. And we started with I Wonder Why, you know. I wasn't really a doo-wop singer, but they wanted to put me with a group, and it kind of got convoluted, and off I went with the group, you know. But I was making sounds. I didn't care, you know.
Like,
I just
you were a born rock and roller.
Yeah, I love rock and roll. I love blues. I love you know.
I'm with you on the blues thing. Well, what did you think when you first heard Elvis Presley?
I loved Elvis Presley. I mean, you know, he was, but for him, it was so natural. He was around it. That's what was happening around him. You know, he had all this, you know, like One Night of Sin or One Night, I forget some of the songs he did. They were like playing that in his backyard, you know, live, you know. I realized how great Elvis Presley was when all us rock and roll artists got together and we recorded an album called The Last Temptation of Elvis. And there's about 25 of us on there, Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen, Lou Reed. We did all these songs. And when I got the final product, it was a CD. I put it in my truck. I'm listening to it. I'm like, no cigar, no cigar, no cigar. You know, I'm thinking, hey, these are great renditions, but Presley, I realized how great he was, you know, because nothing compared to his records. You couldn't get there.
But you know, it's funny because that was mid 1950s. And here you are signing in around 1957. And here you are bringing the what I would call true rock and roll, I mean, out of New York, of all things, you know, because everybody was either L.A. or it was Nashville. You know, we had, you know, there was a lot of acts coming out of Memphis. But here you are coming out of New York. But since then, there's been a ton of acts coming out of New York and Jersey. But, you know, that's what makes rock and roll so great, you know, with so many people coming from different parts of the country. But I've got to ask you, because I was reading and doing some research on your background, and something kind of piqued my interest. How did you end up singing a song with Vic Damone singing backup vocals on the song The Chosen Few? And wasn't that the one that led you to American Bandstand?
I didn't know Vic Damone was on it. I had no idea. No, that was the one with the Timberlands I was telling you about.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, it hit like number one in Boston, and I went to American Bandstand with it. It was called The Chosen Few. That was the record.
Yeah.
It was Dion and the Timberlanes. But when you hear it, it has nothing to do with rock and roll. It's like so... They had the record already cut when I went down there and sang Carl Perkins and Fats Domino songs for them, and you know, and like a Jimmy Reed song. But yeah, that's what I didn't want to follow that. That was a little. It was so off track to me. I said, guys, you know, I can't do this. You got, you know.
Well, how long did doo-wop actually last?
Gee, I don't know. I think after 1963, you know, it seemed like up until 1963, if you look at album covers, everybody's smiling. You know, rock and roll was all in the major key. Like even The Wanderer is a really heavy song. It can be done in a minor key, but everything was done in a major key, happy. People were smiling on album covers. After 1963, after John F. Kennedy got shot, just around there, it seemed like rock and roll took a turn and went down about 5 octaves. And all of a sudden on the album covers, you know, Dylan came in, he brought thinking in single-handedly, the times they are changing, you know, Masters of War, Marvin Gaye, what's going on? You had the war, what is it good for? You know, you had the Four Tops, and people are like staring in on the album covers, like everything got very serious, you know, and it had a down, and listen, I don't get me wrong, I love the 60s rock and roll. It was just a great period of, I never even call the Beatles, like they call it the British invasion. I called it the British infusion. I felt like they really captured the guts and roots of American music and kind of, sang it right back to us, you know, and so did the Stones and Clapton and all those guys, you know, it was a great time in music, I thought, the 60s.
Yeah, because there was a lot of transitions going on in the 1960s. Like you said, things started changing around 1963 because the Beatles came on scene in 1964. Then, you know, the Stones came in. And then we had that period between I probably 67 to about 69. Because of the Vietnam War, you had a lot of these songs that were very heavy in content, and it was driving the narrative of the nation at the same time.
Yeah, Eve of Destruction, and you know, yeah, it seems like the people who listen to like doo-wop never made it to the fore because guitars took over. So I think the people who really there are a lot of people I know from my generation who just went to 1963 and stopped. They didn't move past 1963. I was up at Columbia Records and I was sitting on a piano bench with Aretha Franklin. She was up there. She was a young girl. And they were giving her Al Jolson songs. They didn't know what to do with her. You know, they didn't know what she was about. She didn't know. She was very young. And we're sitting there. I'm playing piano. I'm doing a song called Drip Drop. And so John Hammond Sr. walks in from the room right across the hallway, like 5 feet, 4 feet. He said, and, you know, because he had released that Robert Johnson album and all he was in charge of all the rural blues guys, you know, Furry Lewis and just Lightning Hopkins, all the, you know, Big Joe Williams. And so he come in and he said, Dion, you really got a flair for the blues. You know, back then I knew it. I mean, I never really knew there was a genre that you could, you know, that was, I was all over the place. I was like a dyslexic rock and roller or something. I don't know
what I was. Yeah, but it paid off. But was it your appearance on Paul Whiteman's broadcast or American Bandstand that was the catalyst to be a rock star?
Well, when I was a kid, like I tell you, I had all these Hank Williams songs. And I'm talking about 13, 14. When I would sit on the stoops, This is in New York, even at the church dances and stuff, I'd bring the guitar and I'd sing like Jambalaya or Honky Tonk Blues. I did not know what Jambalaya meant. I did not know what honky tonk meant. All I knew is it felt good coming out of my mouth. You know, jambalaya and a crawfish pie. I had no idea what it meant. You know, if you were talking about spaghetti and meatballs, maybe I'd understand that. But so I would sing this. And there was a talent show called the Paul Whiteman Talent Show. And my parents brought me down there and auditioned. I was on that show. And I sang Jambalaya. I still have the record. It's an acetate. That they put it on one album, but it does exist. And that's what I was doing back then at that age. You know, to me it was, like I said, it was like otherworldly. You know, it was just otherworldly for a kid from an Italian neighborhood where everybody was listening to Frank Sinatra and Jimmy Roselli and Al Martino, or, you know, who, Jerry Vale, you know, and the singing like, oh, I know. And I went like, what the hell, you know? What do they have, a stomach ache? What's wrong with those people?
Yeah, no, I got you. And, you know, you were really a rock and roll star deep inside, just waiting to come out. I mean, it was in you. You already knew doo-wop wasn't really what you wanted to do. You already had the idea of what kind of music you wanted to do.
It's true. You know, it was always inside me. I tell you, a lot of it's coming out now. It's a funny thing, you know. Right before the lockdown, you know, the 2020, I had written about 14 songs, and I had gone into a little studio right here in my neighborhood, and I recorded the songs, and I brought a band in. We filled it out. I got some tracks, and my friend Joe Bonamassa come over, and because his manager lives right down the street here, and he listens to a song called Blues Coming On. He goes, I want to play on that, Dion. So I said, be my guest. Well, you know, Ward, what happened to me was, I know how to make a record. I know how to write a song. I know how to make a record. But when Joe played on it, I realized how limited my thinking is, because when you get an artist who's outside yourself to contribute to something you did, they come in with something they're hearing. You're not hearing it, they're hearing it. And he played a slide guitar on it, and it was amazing. And I'm listening to the thing, and I said, the idea came to me. I said, imagine if I got just called up different guys I know and, you know, get Jeff Beck to play on this ballad. He plays guitar. He can make me cry, that guy. You know, if I could get Clapton to do something on this. And so I start calling people. And they said, yeah, I'll do it. Like, Clapton jumped on it. I was like, okay. So, you know, and Mark Knopfler, there was a song I wrote. I heard Mark Knopfler on it. I never wrote any of these songs for the people. I just heard them on it because I listened to a lot of music. And I got into this this duet thing, or this these albums with, you know, that people could contribute to, and some of my friends could play on it, and we could make some good music together. And I've been enjoying it for like the last 4 years. I've been doing that. It's been a lot of fun. And I had such a good time with Samantha Fish and who else? Ricky Lee Jones and, you know, a lot of these girls that like Patty Scalfa. I had so much fun doing some of these songs with them that I, somewhere along the line about a year ago, I thought, man, it would be nice to be playing with all these women that I listen to that are flying under the radar. A lot of people don't even know them. Like, I don't know. Of course, some people, you know, a lot of people know Susan Tedeschi. You know, and Sue Foley, and, you know, a lot, you know, Carlene Carter.
Well, but Dan, that song you did with Danielle Nicole, oh my gosh. I went back, had to look her up and listen to her sing her own stuff. I was blown away.
Yeah, you know what? To be honest with you, she just did a concert down here in the backyard. That's how, like, under the radar she played. She is in a friend's backyard. He had to come. Ward, I kid you not, she did a concert that she could do in front of 10,000 people. But I would say since Aretha Franklin and Whitney Houston have gone home in glory, that she is the best singer on the planet. This girl could sing. Oh my God, can she sing?
She can sing. She can rock with the best. I love guitar players. I mean, here you play with Joe Bonamassa, probably one of the best modern blues guys on the planet. Then there was Jeff Beck, like you said, Clapton. But my goodness, Danielle Nicole. She can hold her own against anybody.
Oh, you guys, she plays great bass. She's a great musician. You know, she's a great, great musician. She's, and she doesn't think. I mean, you know, it just comes out like she's under the well of creativity. It just pours out of her like, she doesn't try. She just does it.
So you have this new album, Dion and Girlfriends, which is basically you finding out, like, from the blues record you did with all of these amazing guitarists. Then you bring all these amazing women on to this album. How did you go about choosing which ones to have on the album?
Well, like I said, Ward, I listen to a lot of music, especially like blues these days, because it's the only genre where people really express their, you know, it's loose, it's real, it's raw, it's not structured so much to where all the notes are on paper, which I have nothing against all that, because I could even listen to classical music, you know, but I just love expression. And especially the expression in the blues, because it's so loose and so much fun. You could express any emotion, you know, joy, sorrow, worry. You could, it just hurt. You could just express anything within the blues. It's a genre. It's like a form of music just come down out of heaven to make people not whirl inside themselves and explode. They can get it out, you know.
Well, you know, your album kicks off with a very strong blues tune, Soul Force, which the amazing Susan Tedeschi plays on. I mean, I love that song. How did that come about?
Well, I got the word, you know, Soul Force. I just, for some reason, I said, I got to get a girl who's like a Soul Force. Well, I was thinking of Anna Pocovic, but then I love the way Susan Tedeschi, they're both, you know, and Susan Tedeschi was I know her a little better, so I called her, and she's so down to earth, man. She said, of course, I'll jump on it, you know, and she did it, and she come in, and she just rocked it, crushed it. But, you know, what I've been doing, Ward, is I start out the song with this theme, you know, okay, Soul Force. This guy is like a player, man. He could just snap his finger. Women, he has no problem with the women. But this girl is a Soul Force. Not that she's unattainable. It's just that to her, he's almost a joke. He's like, come on, are you that thin of a veneer of a man? Come on. You know, like he never experienced anything. So I have this theme. So, and now the trick is, like, I could start it out, you know, I thought that I could dazzle by distraction. And how could she resist my kind of action? You know, but, and then I end up as strong as I started out. And that's the whole thing, to stay strong right till the end of the song with the theme, you know, and not peter out. And I think I did that with that song, you know. But I have a great co-writer, Mike Aquilino. We honed it out.
Well, it's a great song, but there's a song that really got my attention. There's so many strong songs on this album, but you have one called American Hero with Carlene Carter. That is a very beautiful song.
I appreciate it. Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah. You know, you're watching Fox News or MSNBC or CNN or whatever, and politicians and Hollywood and the tabloids. And I said, I'm getting sick of this. I said, you know, we all have to look inside our own heart and be a hero right where we are to the 10 people that are in our lives, our wives, our kids, our coworkers, our friends. You know, if we could all do that, it'd be a great world, you know, and just hook up like that. And now, because there's a line in the song, it says, "Why are we waiting from afar? Let's be the heroes that we are." So the song really is about the ordinary person. And that's the that's the true American hero. And you don't have to be political to be, a patriot. You know, you don't have to be this or that. You know, a true patriot is someone who knows there's a state of love and works at it to make it real and shares it and is, makes it a better world. And
because when I watched the music video, what I loved was all of the children in the video, because there are future American heroes.
They are. And kids don't know anything about all those lot, you know, the political scene is so, it's almost like you got to be it's so full of lies. And I don't know how you could even get into that area of life. It's such BS, you know?
It is. And then you released I Am to Please with Danielle Nicole. Man, that one rocks.
You know, I wrote that like a Jimmy Reed tune, you know, like right down in the groove, you know, like the first verse I sing like I wrote the song. But then Danielle Nicole come into the studio and she said, "Should I sing it low or should I sing it high? Because you're not in my key." I said, "Sing it high. It'd be good contrast." She goes off into the stratosphere and so the next verse, I sang it a little higher, and then she hit it again, and then I sang it a little. Now, one verse is the same. They just keep escalating because of her energy, you know. And these are the great surprises, if they're good. And with her, it was more than good. It was just very distinctive and fascinating to me, you know.
Well, the album's incredible, but I want to step back in time because I want to ask you about Run Around Sue. So it was you along with Carole King and Ernest Maresca who wrote it. How old were you then? Because I know Carole was at least 19 at the time, but she was already very sought after as a songwriter because she had her first hit at, what, 17?
No, she didn't write Run Around Sue.
No, oh, she wasn't one of the songwriters on it?
No, not at all. No, Ernie and I put that together she's not a songwriter on that. She wrote a song I did called This Little Girl. And she was a friend, you know, but Run Around Sue was written at a neighborhood party. We got everybody singing like a riff, you know. We like I said, we wanted to imitate the Apollo band, you know. So we got like hip hip bum de de hip hip bum de de hip hip bum de de hip ba da ba da 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 hip Hey, we did that for about 2 hours. And the whole room was singing, and we're banging on cardboard boxes and beer bottles, and we're like having people are playing conga drums, and we're just singing the song, and I start writing words to it, and I start getting an idea for a song on top of this riff. And then about 3 days later, I go into the studio and record it, and Ernie and I kind of put it together where it would work as a song. And I bring it back to the neighborhood and I play it for everybody. I said, listen to this. This is what we did at Joey's party the other night. And I blast it and they go, you ruined it. You ruined it. What'd you do? And so I could ruin what we did at the party and get a number one record. So.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I'm going to have to jump on Spotify for, putting in the wrong credits when it comes to certain songs. So they're to blame for putting Carole King's name on that one. But I've got to ask you, because I've seen documentaries, one right after the other, about the Winter Dance Party. And I know that you've been asked questions galore. And I actually had to go back and I watched the 1 hour video you did to correct the history of that night. And, you were the one that survived because you didn't get on the plane with Buddy Holly or Richie Valens or the Big Bopper. I guess it was good that you didn't want to spend the $36.
Right. Remember I told you my parents arguing all the time, Ward? They were arguing about the rent, $36 a month rent in the Bronx. And when Buddy Holly, he was 22 years old. I was 19. And when he chartered that plane, because we were having such horrific experiences on that bus breaking down in 30 below zero weather and crisscrossing the Midwest, that when he rented that plane or chartered it, we were in the room and he told everybody it was $36. I mean, I won the coin toss to get on the plane because one of us had to stay. But when he said $36, I said, whoa, I'm not spending a whole month's rent on an hour and a half flight to Fargo. So I just declined because that was the primary reason for it, the $36. And man, it's 60 years later, isn't it not? It's 1959, 65 years. I don't know how many.
Well, how did you get through the performance that night on the very day that they all three died early that morning?
I did that video. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame came down to my house and because they said nothing makes sense. They were out at the Surf Ballroom listening to stories, and they said, nothing makes sense. Tell us your what happened. So I went from A to Z. And, I found out that my memory was excellent before the crash. After the crash, I remember very little. It's crazy. But we got through it. Bobby V came on the tour. I started singing Donna, a couple of Richie's songs. I did Rave On, and there was a young fella from Texas came up and helped out, and sang some songs. And Jimmy Clanton, I think, joined the tour. You want to know what? My memory's so bad after the crash. I know these guys came up and joined us, but it was like after the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame asked me to talk about it, I talked for a whole hour or an hour and a half. It was cathartic for me. It was like I felt like I could breathe after I told the story. It was like it was inside me. I never really, I don't know if I ever dealt with the grief. I was crying. I was like, it was crazy. I was 19 years old. I I was like numb. There was a place inside me that was numb until I got it out. And it was almost healing to just tell the story, you know.
Well, I was glad that you told it, because as of now, over a million people have seen that video. And like you had said in the video, there had been so many stories about, you know, who said this and who said that, and nobody really knew what was the truth. And you bring it forth. And, you know, I can't even imagine what you must have been thinking, that the only thing that separated you from that plane was $36.
Yeah, you know, I told you my mom died at 104. When she was about 98, I was having lunch with her. And she said, "Dion, I am so sorry that your father and I argued all the time. I know it troubled you. I know it bothered you." I said, "Mom, please, you saved my life." I said, "You don't know. I thought it was a bad thing, but the arguing actually saved my life. So don't worry about it." I said, you know, it was out of instinct. I said, no, I can't do that. But, you know, yeah, it was just.
Well, did you ever go back and perform at the surf room?
No, I never did. I don't know why. Listen, I love those guys. They were great songwriters and artists and brothers and friends and just great people. They were just wonderful people. Buddy was just amazing, statuesque, you know, and the Big Bopper was just, he was a joy to be with, you know. He was full of joy, and Richie was just great heart, you know. He was warm guy, just very warm hearted, and I just want to make him proud. I miss them on a lot of levels. But you know, in my faith, relationships do not end. They never end. In fact, they move forward. Because my priest said to me, he said, "Dion, they're closer to the beatific vision. They're open to more of God's grace, and they're growing. So you be open to God's grace. And by the time you see them again, your relationship will have moved forward, you know?"
Well, did you find the Lord, or did the Lord find you?
That's a good question. I don't think I'm that smart to find anything. I think I was, in some way, I think when it comes to God, because I came into recovery in about 55 years ago. I was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and you know, in the mid 60s, and I got down on my knees one night and I said, "God," I said, "it would be nice to be closer to you. I don't know what I'm doing." And when I got up, I was changed. I haven't been the same since. So I think in some way you have to be open. Maybe 2%. He does the rest. Like, it's a free gift. But I think maybe there's 2% you have to be open. You just have to say, "I'm here to receive. You know, I'm open."
Yeah, it's the humility. It's a lot of people may not know, but it's really the feeling of surrendering when you don't know you're surrendering. And the Lord knows that. You know, He knows we're not the smartest, but He takes us where we're at. And then if we give Him the open door, He's going to take it.
Well, you know, all I know is I'm so grateful it happened to me, because I can't imagine living the last 55 years without Him and my faith. I think my success, not only just making records, but, you know, as a husband, as a father, as a friend, I think it's all due to my faith and having Him in my life, you know, and connecting. And I, you know, it is the season of Lent right now, right? I went to church yesterday, got my ashes. I think it's a time that people should reconnect with that love, because we could certainly use it. The whole nation
Well, yeah, we can. But do you still sing any of your gospel songs in concert mixed with your rock and blues tunes?
Yeah, once in a while. Yeah, to me, I love gospel songs, man. They're uplifting, you know, and they take you higher. They take you to a higher reality. And God knows we need that.
Amen to that. Well, what did you feel like when you won the Dove Award in 1984?
Well, I like that album, and I like being around the people, and it felt good. You know, it felt good. All that stuff feels good. You know, you feel like you're connected, you know, and that's a good feeling.
Well, in 1989, you were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, same time as the Rolling Stones and Otis Redding. What was that experience like for you?
Man, that it's like otherworldly. It was kind of nice. I enjoyed it, you know, because I come from an era that you didn't get awards. Well, I do have 12 gold records on the wall, but you know, the Grammys weren't like what they are now. You know, like all that stuff. You really, there was no real TV shows to honor people and stuff. So when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame did induct me, I had a great night. It was Stevie Wonder also, and the Temptations, and Lou Reed inducted me. So it was a fun night for me. It just made me feel good. I felt like, again, I feel like what I've been doing, that very thing I told you at the beginning of the interview, that I want to fashion a song to take people on a trip to transmit this feeling of enchantment. I felt like, wow, I did it. You know, and that is a, you know, and you want to know the best compliment that I've ever gotten. I think I've gotten so many of them that I really remember. But one was just awesome. I was in the dressing room one time, and a young kid came in. He was about 19 years old. He said, "Dion," he said, "you know that story you told about Jimmy Reed, how he made you feel inside? He said, you do that for me." And I thought, okay, that's it. I could leave now. I made it. That's all I want. That's all I ever wanted to do, you know?
And see, you know, that's the beauty about music. And it's the beauty about, you know, recording artists. We all have memories of our idols, our music idols. Music makes memories. You know, all of the songs that you have written and performed, they're part of people. They're part of millions of people's lives. I mean, what does that make you feel like?
When you say it, I'm thinking, wow, maybe that's true. I think it is true in a lot of ways. That's a good feel. That makes you feel good. Makes you feel like, you know, like your life is like, you know, you're connected to others and God, and it makes sense. It makes, everything makes sense, you know. I don't know if you aware of this, but this kid, Charles Messina, I say a kid, he's like, everybody's a kid to me, but he wrote a play called The Wanderer, and it's going to open this fall on Broadway. It's called The Wanderer, and the way he wrote the story, it's unbelievable, because it has all that rock and roll street history, and it has action, the gangs, in the 50s, that, you know, my early juvenile delinquent days, I was like a wild, I was kind of crazy. And then I fell in love with this girl who moved down from Vermont, who I'm married to today. I mean, over 60 years. So, you know, there's romance, there's betrayal, there's overcoming, there's a lot of laughs, there's great music, the way he placed the music in the play. So it has, it's a play about transformation. It's a play about hope, which a lot of people don't have today. You know, they have experience, they have strength, they have knowledge, they have this, that, but they have no hope. You know, you wonder when they're going to get there, you know?
Yeah, and that's what we need. And that's the thing about the power of music. You know, music, regardless what decade it is, there are songs that are uplifting. They bring us hope. They make us just feel good. You know, anytime that maybe someone's not, maybe they're sad or depressed, but then the right song comes to them at the right time and then just kind of lifts them up. And like, as you say, brings hope back into their heart. And it's people like you that do that.
I hope so.
Well, I'm going to ask you because you have this brand new album coming out. And I saw that the upcoming vinyl release of the album is a double album. You know, a lot of people today don't know what a double album is. So is there something special added besides the 12 songs?
No, I guess they're pretty long. I don't know. The other two, there was 14 songs on each of them, you know, Blues with Friends and Stomping Ground. So they were double albums. But the vinyl is beautiful, the way that KTBA, my record company, puts them together. We have pictures of all the girls, of all the artists that have contributed to the album. And I have little stories about how I met them, about the song. And, you know, I should have taken it up here to show you how it looks. But, you know, little stories. And Darlene Love wrote some liner notes about when she sang "He's a Rebel," she was singing about me. She said, "You are an outsider, boy." So we were singing about you, boy. So
you know, you have performed and sang with some of the biggest stars in the world. Was there anyone in particular that you were kind of starstruck with?
Well, you know, I've always been taken with Dylan, Bob Dylan. You know, for some reason, you know, a lot of people don't know he's a great blues singer, and you know, and guys like Springsteen, I really have I don't know, like a connection to, you know, I for some reason, like, the, you know, we resonate with each other. So, but you know, I tell you a guy that I did a show with, and I did a show, the Ralph Emery show in Nashville way back when, with George Jones, Aaron Neville. I sang Abraham Martin and John with him. And Toby Keith was on the show. He was a young guy. And I really took a liking to this guy. And man, I just got to say something about it. He was just a top shelf guy, man. He used to go out and really entertain the troops, you know, the real way, not just to take photos and get a photo op. He would actually do a show for him. You know, he was the real deal. So just being around people like that, you know, what could I tell you? I feel very blessed. I feel like the luckiest guy in the world that I get to live this life, you know, meet these people.
You know, you bring up the song, and I was going to ask you, because you bring up the song Abraham, Martin, and John. That came out in 1968. I actually went back and listened to it, and I was like, oh, that was Dion. But then when I started really listening to the song, that was the type of song that was the epitome of 1968. It had the sound. It had the lyrics. It fit the time period perfectly. How did that song come to you?
I tell you, I don't know where you got that from, because there was a lot of Jimi Hendrix going around and Ray Charles. But that song, you know, a friend of mine wrote that song 20 minutes after Bobby Kennedy got shot. He was so frustrated because, you know, after Martin Luther King got shot, Bobby Kennedy stood over his grave, said, "Who's going to be the next senseless victim of gun violence?" And he got shot. And my friend Dick Holla wrote the song in 20 minutes, but it had, didn't sound anything like I recorded it. So I took the song, I had this gut string guitar, and I started picking, because I was hanging out in Greenwich Village at the time and listening to Tim Hardin and these guys, you know, and Richie Havens, and hanging out with John Hammond. And I started picking the song and I started putting a melody to it and doing it. And my wife and her mother said, "You know, that's the gospel, man. You should do that song. That's a song about, you know, about, you know, you could kill the dreamer, but you cannot kill the dream. People like us, we pick up on it and carry it further. You should do that song." So, because to me, I didn't want to sound like you know, you know, like you're trying to, I don't know, what do they call that when you, I don't you know, you want to exploit something, you know, kind of like, it kind of bothered me about it. But they took my mind. They said, no, it has nothing to do with that. It's real. You can do it. You know, it has nothing to do with exploitation or anything like that.
Yeah. So, it's a beautiful song.
Yeah, I did it in the right spirit. You know, I was trying to say that, you know, here are guys that are models. You know, they try to do something good, and you know we ought to carry it further. That's all. Pick up on what they had, this state of love that, like I said, does exist, and they were trying to make it real. They were working at it, but you know, it's a crazy world.
You know, it's funny how you tell the story of that song, because being written 20 minutes after Bobby Kennedy was killed. And at the very same time, Elvis was filming the 68 TV special. And the writers wrote If I Can Dream at the exact same time.
Yeah, it was a crazy time in this country, very restless. And, you know, we were trying to bring people together through the music, you know.
So, well, you know, I've got one last question, because I could keep you forever, Dion. But with such a storied career, what is your most memorable moment?
Most memorable moment. You know, one that comes to mind is I did the Arsenio Hall show for Martin Luther King's birthday. And I did Abraham, Martin, and John on it. I wish I had a tape of it. Somebody had to take, I don't know if it's still up on YouTube, but, and I told a story to him about how I put it together and how the country changed and what I was trying to do. And after the show, when the show ended, Quincy Jones came out of the green room and he hugged me. And he said to me, he said, "You are really spiritually evolved." And then Smokey Robinson, with those light green eyes, he grabs my hand and he's looking at me. He's just looking at me. He just squeezes my hand and walks away. Like, but you know, he said so much without saying anything. So I just remember that moment with those guys that, again, I feel like I connected, and that's a good feeling, Ward.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering now if you and Smokey Robinson ought to recut that song and do it together.
Yeah, he did a good job on it.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, Dion's new album, Dion and Girlfriends, debuts March the 8th. And I will tell you this, it is a must have album. And if you're like me, it's also going to be available on vinyl. So you need to head over to DeonDiMucci.com for all things Dion. Check out his 42 albums, and he shows no signs of slowing down. Dion, I cannot believe that you're 84, because you have as much energy as Mick Jagger does on stage.
84 is the new 83. Hey, what? I thought getting old would take longer.
Yeah, take longer? No, I think it definitely creeps up on us very, very quickly. But wow, over 6 decades of music. Can you believe that?
I got to tell you, thank you for the time. I appreciate it. And thank you. Thank you for your time, Ward. And have a great day. God bless you, man.
Hey, God bless you too. And ladies and gentlemen, again, head over to DeonDiMucci.com. Check out the brand new album again, Dion and Girlfriends. And I will tell you this, you need to add that one to your collection. You need to add the blues album to your collection, because these things, his duet albums, I mean, these are the type, this is the type of music you want to hear. I love this stuff. And Dion, you like I said at the very beginning, you just keep rocking and rolling.
Rock on, buddy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for watching and listening. And remember, we are available not only on YouTube and on television Monday through Friday on the CTN Network, but also we are on a dozen audio platforms. So head over to either drwardbond.com or bondoncinema.com and check out all the happenings that we're bringing you, as well as the legendary icons like Dion coming onto the program. And again, I want to thank everyone for watching and listening. And as for me, hey, I'll see you next time.